So this is your last chance to ask us difficult questions. And we'll try to give brief answers so that will give the greatest opportunity for as many of you who wish to ask. Yes. Come out.
I'd like to go back to the parable of the city.
The city.
And my question is, who is the king or the royal minister to whom the Buddha turns?
Oh, it's not the Buddha.
Well,
it's the man in the parable.
Well, but he says, so too I saw the ancient path.
That's right.
So, the question is, if this is, the man is the Buddha himself,
yeah,
then who is the king or the royal minister whom he asked for help in renovating the city? And if this is a more of a projection upon the future of us reading this and thinking that there was a Buddha,
uh-huh,
who once upon a time found this path and we are now rediscovering it, who is this king or royal minister whom we are asking to help renovate?
Okay. All right. Well, look, first of all, an answer that would be relevant to the Buddha's own time in about 400, 4th century, 5th century BC, before the Common Era. It could have been either King Pasenadi of Kosala, it could have been King Bimbisara of Magadha, it could have been King Ajatasattu of Magadha, it could have been Brahmin Vasakara, who was the chief minister of King Bimbisara of Magadha. Now, shall I go on? And but you see, the Buddha established his main centers in proximity to these kings. So it shows that, you know, he was supported in his mission by these political figures who were both his students and also his protectors, the ones who guaranteed for him security. So what it points to there, I think, is actually something actually quite real. And these figures are not, you know, minor personages who pop up here and there in the canon. They play a significant role in the Buddha's life from the awakening until his death. But again, we don't have time to go into all of that. What it means now is basically what it's pointing to. We don't live in a kingdom anymore. We don't live in that sort of power structure. We can't go to, you know, some great ruler and say, you know, please help me rebuild this city. We live in a democratic society, so the whole configuration of possibilities are changed. But I think the main point is that the practice of the path, you may find this path, you might find this vision of another kind of civitas. But that is something that you'll never achieve on your own. It has to be done through the support, or with the support, of those who have wealth and power in our societies. And that would therefore be, I think, less an issue today with political power, but certainly with the business community, with the Buddhist community, all of those with whom we can share a similar vision. And something like Tovana is in a way a kind of embryonic community and therefore society. And any such group is achieved not by one person alone, but by people gathering together and working to realize this goal. So it points very much to how the Dhamma and the realization of its values is not just a private matter for you or me, but it actually entails the mobilization of social forces.
First of all, I'd like to say that I do like your perspective on secular Buddhism, on having self responsibility, spiritual path, perhaps self responsibility for self, for other people, and for the world. And with this in mind, I have this question: how come that the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago, and he teach this profound teaching?
Uh-huh.
And I can't say for sure, but it seems that nothing much has changed in the world.
In the world?
Like, the world seems pretty the same. So there are Buddhist countries.
Uh-huh.
There is much of Buddhist religion. There are places where the path is. But I can see this also in other religion, in other paths, even before the Buddha. And he didn't build this utopia in the city. It's not.
That's right.
And also, in this in mind, I have the question: how do we do it
today?
Now? Because I think religious have an answer of how you give it to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
It may be sometimes not give the core spiritual thing to the next generation, but it gives something. It is a glue that gives something to the next generation. And how can a secular spiritual path
realize that sort of society?
Yeah, be distributed in the world and be...
Okay, briefly. As a social visionary, the Buddha failed. India, all the problems India has today are pretty much the same ones it had at the Buddha's time. Right? The caste system is still in place. All of the stuff the Buddha was criticizing all of that time ago is basically how India is largely today. At least Hindu India. Now, the reasons as to why Buddhism failed in its social vision are complex, and I can't go into them all now, but essentially I think what happened was that after the Buddha's death, quite quickly the Dharma became seen as a pretty much a spiritual practice rather than a social movement. And I think that happened to some extent because the leading figures who controlled the community after the Buddha's death were former Brahmins, particularly a man called Mahakasyapa. It's a complicated story, and this is really just a sort of a supposition. But in subsequent generations, until Buddhism collapsed altogether in India in about the 12th century, the social dimension of Buddhism was only periodically realized. Buddhist communities did not in India, ancient India, subscribed to the caste system, so that when Buddhism collapsed, it was reabsorbed into the matrix of Indian thought. Philosophically, it began to become more and more like Vedanta. It also influenced the developments of later Vedanta. Religiously, it became more and more a cult of different gods and deities. If you go to these places in India now, you see Buddhist, lots of tantric Buddhism particularly, is a very much a popular devotional cult. It looks hardly any different from the equivalents in Hinduism at the same time. So Buddhism merged back into the matrix of Indian thought and religion. It lost its distinctiveness, and after the Muslim invasions was unable to recover its identity. And the Buddhist community, since they were out of the caste system, tended then to convert to Islam. Most of the strongholds of Buddhism in the Indian subcontinent now are the strongholds of Islam. So Pakistan, was the main, one of the big centers of Buddhism. It was essentially a Buddhist part of the subcontinent. It's called Gandhara. Kashmir was likewise a strong Buddhist center, and Bengal, which is now Bangladesh. So you can see, in fact, in the demographics of India, that the predominantly Muslim areas now were previously the areas where Buddhism was strong. So in that sense, Buddhism in India failed. But it generated for many centuries a very rich culture of thought. Buddhism contributed greatly to the development of logic and epistemology, even mathematics in India. The concept of zero was very much coming out of the Buddhist idea of shunya, emptiness. Buddhism subsequently, when it spread elsewhere in Sri Lanka, Southeast Asia, it generated extraordinary cultures and civilizations. Likewise in China, the Tang Dynasty in China, which is one of the great periods of Chinese civilization, was essentially a Buddhist state. The Ming Dynasty was founded, inspired by Buddhist vision to create a society to prepare for the descent of Maitreya. Tibet was an actual Buddhist state ruled by monks that flourished for hundreds of years. And you can see similar developments in Japan, in Korea. So to say that Buddhism did not have a civilizing influence is not true. In all areas of life in throughout Asia, it had an equivalent impact to that of Christianity in Western Europe. But?
Were the people happier?
Happier? How would we find out? I mean,
I know that, but I think
we cannot know.
For example, I mean, what is interesting is in China. In China, Buddhism actually brought the notion of equality between people and compassion for everyone instead of just for one family. And out of that, you started to have a very strong movement in the 600 of welfare. But then, you know, you have a geography, history, and you have, you know, culture. So there is kind of, you know, ups and down. You know, it goes up, then it goes down.
So yeah, you can see this. Now, clearly, for any spiritual, religious, philosophical, political movement to translate itself from first principles into a civilization, this is not something that's going to happen overnight. But if human beings do not try to live their values in their world, then one has to question whether those ideas, you know, are anything other than a sort of personal indulgence. And so I think, let's say, facing the global crises that we do today, where do we draw our inspiration from? Where can we find ideas that can inform not only our personal response, but also a wider communal, social, and collective response? And Buddhism, I feel, has something to offer there. Whether, either in this generation or in the next generation, that will be developed further, I can't say. But it seems that, in a way, our responsibility, no matter what we believe, or no matter what views we hold, is to leave a legacy where the world is maybe fractionally better. And we cannot predict what will happen, but I feel it's our responsibility to pass on what we deeply value to our children, to those who will live after we are dead. And I feel that in that sense, Buddhism is still a living tradition, although it has suffered enormous cultural destruction, largely at the hands of communism.
Next
China
question.
And next question here.
Stephen, you said you were going to be sure.
Well, difficult question. This is a yes/no one, I hope. No.
I have a question regarding equanimity.
Ah, right. Per mattina, allora.
Can you speak louder? I will try. Sometimes I feel that I use equanimity. I don't know if seems not to react. Even though I know it's the right thing now to react and to respond, I feel like I tell myself, okay, don't react, be calm, accept things like that, only because I'm too shy or too embarrassed to react. And I use it, and I know this is not how it should be. And I have a feeling that the equanimity has the power to make things the opposite, exactly the opposite. Like if I practice equanimity and I'm really with it, I will be stable enough to react, but I don't know how to make the change.
No, I mean, then it's practice. I mean, the question, okay, the question was about equanimity, that the person was felt sometimes she was using equanimity as a way not to get into trouble, so to speak, you know. I'm okay, keep calm, you know. And so she thinks that maybe there is another type of equanimity from which you can be stronger to respond. Yes, but it is really something to practice, because equanimity, it has two effects. Like you say, one effect is to say, no, it's okay, you know, yeah. And often that actually leads to resentment. This is what is interesting. If you say, no, I'm fine, it's fine. And then later on, a little thing will happen, and you will react, and the person say, but where does this come from, you know? Instead of, and that's why now I have seen that if you use it that way, if I use it that way, then later on it will come out, if it's kind of using it more as repression. So I find what is more useful, if it's possible, is to address it, is to recognize the situation and to address, if possible, the situation, if we can, at the beginning of it, and not again and again, no, and then it will be problematic. So that's one way, is to really start to see the sign. When you start to feel something is funny, you feel funny about something, you have these two voices, one saying, it's okay, the other one, and it's to recognize that, something is not right. But then to try to understand what is really the problem, because then you're going to tell you a lot of stories which are going to be hooked onto pattern. And so it's kind of to really see what is really the problem here, to see if one can see, you know. And so that's one way. Another way is to see that the equanimity we have to build over time within ourselves, what I call the power of the awareness, the stability within ourselves, the whole organism, and so that we can just do it. Then to see that at time, equanimity will help us to creatively engage, what I call creatively respond. But again, it will depend on the condition. And so sometime you will learn it is better to not say anything, because you've learned that if you say something, however nice or creative, it's also going to work on the other side. So then the equanimity is actually a safety mechanism. Maybe here I should, you know, let it go for a little while and then see if later I can do something about it or not. Other time you can see, oh yes, you can start to learn to start to have the courage. Feel the courage to see, but it's not just to have the courage, in a way you need to have the wisdom also. What is the best thing to say? How can I put it in such a way that it doesn't sound aggressive or defensive? And so the person is not going to kind of have an automatic response. And then that again you have to practice. You have to practice within yourself, but also practice in actual life of saying something and saying, oh yes, that works. Or saying, oh, I say this, that doesn't work. So to me, the equanimity is very important to go with the wisdom, with the kind of understanding of the inner, the outer condition, and trying to also work with the language in terms of right speech to see what is the less threatening way to say that, or the way which would be opening so the person doesn't feel attacked, or how can I say this so people can hear it. I remember once in England, I was living in England and at the beginning and in a community, and then there was water, huge rain, huge storm, and water coming down the chimney and really flooding the room, the guest room. And so I ran into the corridor and I see somebody. I said, "Come." And he looked at me and he passed by. And he was generally quite a friendly person. I thought, so later on, I did it on my own. Later on, I came, "But why did not you help me?" He said, "I did not like the way you did it. You know, you ordered me. I don't like that." So after that, I learned to say, "Do you mind? Could you possibly, could you consider?" And then I kind of, you know, try to find the best vocabulary which would work in that culture. So it's also, we have to kind of, you know, I think be creative there. It's not just the equanimity and the courage. It's, in a way, the creative manifestation. And then it can become like a play, like an exploration.
I'm a little confused about anatta.
Oh, really?
Exactly. On the one hand, I can't accept this saying that there is no self. I mean, to say that the self is something that changes is something we all know. I mean, the body changes, our feeling changes. You don't have to be very aware to know that you change. So what's the big deal? But it's a big difference than to say that there is no self and that the self changes. I mean, there are things that don't change, like gender, which is probably, for me at least, the most prominent condition in which I experience the world. So how can you say that there is no self?
I'm not saying there is no self.
Of the hand, which is not flesh and bone, it's something which
That's right. Exactly. That's exactly it. Yeah, that's it.
You have to see, you have to see first what the, you see, we have to put ourselves back at the time of the Buddha.
Yeah.
At the time of the Buddha had a major problem because they believe in a big self. And that was what the Buddha was refuting. So you see, in a way, we are kind of, now we, I mean, some people believe in a soul and whatever, but in a way the Buddha was saying there is no Atman. That's what he was saying. And so in a way we have to translate it as there is no self. But there is no self doesn't mean, as you say, it's not a big deal. Yes, I totally agree. But in those days, for the Buddha to say there is no Atman, that was a big deal. As much as Stephen saying that, you know, "I don't believe in rebirth," that's the same. So it's kind of, again, what is the context?
But this is the one hand of the question, and the other
hand. Sure.
That paradoxically, while meditating, I do feel this liquidity that you're speaking about and that you can't put your finger on it. And then what I feel is, you know, I can be in meditation and feel so aware and sensitive and blissful, and then I open my eyes, it fades away in less than a minute, and by the time I'm halfway to the dining room, I'm already thinking, "Oh, he pissed me off," and, you know, it all vanishes. And so what I'm asking is, how do we accumulate knowledge? How if there is no place it goes to, it's just this moment that I feel aware, then how does it ever build up to anything? How does it?
That's where the constancy comes in. You see, that's the thing, we have to be careful with change. It doesn't mean everything changes every second, you know. In some way, in terms of the thought, the feeling, the sensation, yes, it can go quite fast, or sometimes it can go quite, you know, remain a little, you know, in a certain way. So there is a relative change and there is a relative constancy. It's a bit like the ocean. The ocean, the constitution of the ocean, the water, the salt, remain relatively similar. But the shape of the ocean can really change. It can be very calm, it can be really, you can have this huge wave, and it's the same stuff. But it has different configurations. So in terms of the experience, personally, I feel it builds up in the organism. Because the organism, I mean, until one I die, my organism remain relatively constant up to a point. And so I personally feel it builds inside the organism, that there is some kind of ground that is built inside oneself in the whole organism, I would say. That's the way I would say.
It has a lot to do with memory. And we remember things. We understand something, we remember it. And at that point, that becomes a tacit understanding. I know lots of things. You know, I know French, but that doesn't mean I'm conscious of French right now, but I know it. And the same with meditation practice, or any kind of development, is that you go through time, you do different practices, you study, you think, you read, and as you do that, you learn things. And that is an accumulation of knowledge. It's accumulation of understanding. And that is held in our memory. We can recall it, we can draw upon it. You ask me a question, I call upon what I tacitly know. And as I continue through my life, hopefully, that body of tacit understanding continues. And it is held within the continuity of this story I call Stephen. I think the self, the Buddha does not say there is no self. Or when he does say that, it simply refers to a critique of the prevailing belief in a permanent fixed self. But he recognizes, as I gave in that example, that the self is a process. And I think we might understand that nowadays as a kind of narrative. So when I'm, you know, when you sit in meditation, what do you do? You tell your story. You narrate yourself. And of course, we also censor and edit ourselves. So that, you know, what had happened in the past is usually edited and modified to make us come out looking perhaps a little bit better than we were. And that, I think the self is closest to the, let's say, a character in a novel or a story, that the character resolves crises, learns things, overcomes things, engages with unforeseeable events, deals with them in a particular way in consistency with his or her character, and the resolution of the novel is usually that some kind of crisis has been overcome and something has been learned, and the character is therefore somehow that much richer, that much more complete at the end of the novel. But the novel is fake, because a novel has page one and it ends at a certain point. Life is open-ended, much more open-ended. Sorry? Ours isn't. Well, at some point, of course, we'll die. But in a sense, our story will always be incomplete. We often think that my story is terribly interesting, and people's first novels is usually, what an interesting person I am. But in fact, when you write this stuff down, what it actually shows is, what a terribly ordinary sort of person I am. So we delude ourselves in thinking that our life is somehow more like that of a fictive character than it really is. It's much more arbitrary and somehow disjointed and fragmented. But nonetheless, we hold that thread together, and that is the continuity of our life. And that is us, that is you, that is yourself. The Buddha's not negating that, yes.
No.
Did you have something? Yes.
Yeah. I would like to question the first novel, Truth.
Okay, question it.
Inspired by the Dharma I talked yesterday. The first novel, Truth, says that no suffering, life is suffering.
Uh-huh.
And I don't quite agree with that.
Uh-huh. Well, it doesn't actually say that.
What does it say?
It says there is suffering.
Okay, I would like to understand suffering.
Uh-huh.
I see it two parts. There is a kind of suffer, the body suffers.
Uh-huh.
Aging, death, giving birth. And there is a kind of suffering which I want to have something, someone, I lost something.
Mm-hmm.
I, th- this kind of suffering which doesn't go with the body.
Mm-hmm.
And this I call suffering, and the other one I call pain. The body is in pain.
Mm-hmm.
So there is pain in life, but this is the existence of, how do you call it, when you have two ends within?
Polarities.
So you have to have the pain to feel the life, but I don't think that you have to have the other suffering. The suffering of the I-one, I-ness and minus is not unnecessary. And you can see people, for example, all the ones we call primitive,
Native cultures,
yeah. For example, they don't suffer.
Oh yeah?
They don't suffer. They have, okay, they get a bruise, okay, but they don't have like, how you call it, depression, they are not into, I don't know, kind of, I want, they don't have that. Why?
Well, I think that's a quite debatable point. We do have a tendency to romanticize native cultures, but I do think at some level living that sort of simple natural existence is devoid of many of the sufferings that we create for ourselves. And in that sense, yes, I agree that we do manufacture unnecessary anguish and worry and pain and mental stuff that we don't really need to do. But I can't quite see the point you're making. I mean, there are some sufferings that are unnecessary.
No, I can continue.
Added. Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Yes.
Because the way they live the life is that they. I know about Native Americans, and I didn't explore the other ones, but the Indians, they live as the tribe is their family, but it's not their only family. The nature is their family, the sun is the family, the fire is the family, the food they hunt is family, is part of their existence. They live with enormous respect for a force which is much greater than themselves, and when they hunt, for example, they ask for the force, each time they give it a different name, the Great Spirit, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They ask for it to help them on their quest. They ask forgiveness for the one they are supposed to eat food. Lots of respect.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't own anything. They have their houses, which it's not theirs. Nothing is theirs. They don't have an I-ness. They don't have a minus. And if I think about it, and actually it's not my thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It's a friend's thinking which I'm bringing here. And where did it all start? And so it all starts with the first person that put up a fence.
That's
and
right.
Said, these are my tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever is going to try to take my tomatoes, I'm going to kill him.
That's right, exactly.
And this is my stream of water, which I don't know how you can say that, but this is my stream of water, and I'm going to stop it right here and going to take the water to houses I want to have, and the animals come at 5 o'clock in the evening how they're used to, and there is no water. Now this is suffering, and when you create suffering, you get suffering. And so this reality has suffering, but it doesn't have to have it. It's because the way we act, we get it, and depression and everything that goes with it. And I don't know, I think life is the present. Life is the great gift.
Of course it is. Well, actually, the Buddhist creation myth is actually much like that. They say that the conflict arose because in the old days, food would grow and people would eat it. And then one day, in some person's terrain, the food didn't grow, so they then stole it from the neighbor. And they then started creating borders, quite literally as you said. But it's that world that the Buddha is addressing. The Buddha's not addressing the possibly more harmonious reality that preceded it.
So I think that if you want to stop suffering, this is the point where you need to take today
to go back to,
and that's why I asked you about when it was written, all the teaching, because I think in this gap, I think the Buddha knew all of that, but in this gap of years between the writings and the when it happened, something got lost in the way, because now it's like an excuse for us to go on the way we do.
Well, the problem is that at the Buddha's time, this was already the period in Indian history when the first cities were being established, when that simple form of life was no longer operative, and the Buddha was addressing the condition of urban life. I don't think that changed an awful lot before the things were written down. That was already in place at the Buddha's time, and that was, in fact, one of the reasons the Buddha, in a sense, said what he did, because he was addressing the kind of world that we now live in, although it's far, far more complex and magnified. But that's the starting point. One can have ideas of how much nicer it would be not to live like that, but I think the genie is out of the bottle, and I don't know whether we'll ever get back there. We have to deal with the situation we're in now.
Yeah, the thing is, I say that there is laws in this world which we don't have a hold on, and when we break the laws, we suffer.
Exactly.
Yeah. So suffering is.
Well, exactly. You're right.
It doesn't have to be that way.
That's right. Exactly. But you see, that's exactly what the Buddha's saying. He's not saying it's all miserable. He's saying there's a way to resolve this problem if we live differently.
Okay.
If we stop greed and hatred and all these things. Next question. Sorry. Yes. Can you speak up? I can't hear.
You see, it depends on the context, on the situation, because it depends if it's mental, emotional, or physical. It depends if it's something that happened just before you came to see it, or right. So if it's something deep that you carry, I would say again, it depends if it's a light manifestation or if it's habitual or if it's intense. If it's intense, I would not focus on it because it's so much there anyway. And that's what the Buddha recommends, to turn the attention away to something which is not so intense. If it's more of light, then you can be with it and you can try to stay with it where it is, which often is in the body. And then you can see, am I increasing it in the mind by the story I am telling myself? I am feeding that. I think that's one of the meditation I did not do because we did not have the time, is what I call to focus on the feeling sensation in the body, but without naming it, without going into the story of it, and just staying with the sensation of it. And the fluidity of it, and how we feel. Generally, we feel it, you know, in the middle of the body, but sometimes other places. And trying to go to that place, to know it, to experience it, but in a more spacious way. But as long as it's not too intense. If it's extremely intense, you won't be able to have the spaciousness. And then to focus on it, we generally increase it. So I would say it's better to look at it when it's just a little lighter. And then you try to be with it differently. Because generally we just feed it, we just build it up. We're trying to stay with it and to see it is painful, but actually it is bearable. So actually to have the patience to be with the feeling there, and generally it's interesting. Sometimes it just dissolves or it changes into something else. But again, it depends the situation and the conditions.
In front, yes?
Yeah.
A short one. I wanted to know, please, in last book or chapter, the Buddha was talking about the social civilization, social vision. You were talking about.
Well, it's the trouble is that these ideas are scattered through the canon. There's not one particular book called Social Theory. You have to sort of.
But you have it in your living with the devil, haven't you?
Yeah, it's actually quite complicated because these ideas are found here and there and everywhere. I can give you if you look at your handout, I think it actually gives a technical reference at the end. But these are really not collected in any one particular book or one particular chapter of a book. One sutta that's quite good is called the Sigalavada Sutta, which is the discourse he gave to lay people as to how to lead their lives. And that's in the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses of the Buddha. You can find that there. But unfortunately, otherwise, you have to sort of jump around all over the place to find these particular images or parables or ideas.
Otherwise, you have to find books like either Stephen's book, Living with the Devil, or like the book of, for example, David Loy.
I don't know whether David's stuff really gets into the Pali materials. I'm not familiar.
Otherwise, you have
that.
Ambedkar. But then you have to find it. You see, it's kind of a little technical too. But then also you have books, certain books which write about engaged Buddhism, and they kind of like the book of King and Queen. What's the title? Yeah, you have some books which are about engaged Buddhism, and generally they look at how people nowadays use Buddhism in a way which is socially conscious and address certain situation, and within that sometime you get a little of the original material. And if you go on our website, I have a list of books, and some are about this kind of material. Yeah?
Yesterday someone asked about
guilt.
Guilt?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, I forgot. So, was guilt in Buddhism?
Well, there's not really a strong concept that corresponds exactly to our Western concept of guilt. Guilt seems to be kind of popular in the Judeo-Christian tradition, in some respects. That we were discussing this with Karen. There are two terms that are used in Buddhist moral philosophy. Hiriya Notapa, which means something like self-respect, a sense, it's sometimes translated as a sense of shame, but I think that's not quite right. A sensitivity to the needs and the views of others. You restrain yourself from committing certain actions because were you to do so, you would find it more difficult to live with yourself. Not necessarily. Guilt is usually something that you feel having done something wrong. Then you feel guilty, right? It kind of weighs you down. There is, in the Tibetan tradition, they speak about remorse. But that's different because remorse is to regret what you have done. Guilt is a kind of rather neurotic feeling that feels as though it's in your belly somewhere and you can't rid yourself of it. But I've not really come across that kind of idea or that experience expressed in classical Buddhist texts.
It's ritual of repentance.
Yeah.
And what was interesting in Korea, which for me was really very special, is that you made a mistake. I mean, we had if we made a mistake, and once somebody made a mistake and Master Kuzan pointed it out to him, and if he had been Korean, he would have said, I made a mistake, bowed down 3 times, and then it was forgotten forever after. And nobody would ever mention it again, and you would just endeavor not to do it again. When with the Westerner, they were always kind of explaining why, and then they had good reason to do it, and Master Kuzan was sitting there, oh la la, would be so much easier, you know? And what was interesting to me with this process of forgiveness, you could say repentance and forgiveness, was that really, the forgiveness was really total. Like there was no, generally we forgive, but we don't forget, I feel, in the Western, in the modern world. But there really, if you admitted your fault, it meant that you understood that, there was condition which made this mistake arise, and that in the future you would endeavor not to repeat the same conditions. And so it was understood that the act of repentance, in a way, was an act of understanding. Well, I even know a monk who was extremely impulsive, dreadfully impulsive, really bad. So bad that finally one day he killed somebody, not because he wanted really to kill the person, but because it was so impulsive and he had a knife in his hand. And, you know, by accident, he kind of killed somebody. So he went to jail. But even him, when I talked to a friend, another friend monk, about that guy, he said, yes, well, you know, he made a mistake. There was no feeling that, you know, he was a sinner forever after, nobody would talk to him, nobody would care for him ever. No, he made a mistake, he went to jail for it, and we continue. He still stays in the family and everything. It, to me, it was very interesting to see that. To see that kind of like, I would be, but come on, he's done this, you know, he's a terrible person. And they would not see it that way. It was very interesting to see that.
I just want to defend my question as it was rephrased when you said it.
Yeah, sure.
I asked it a little differently, yes, in relation to the Korean custom you mentioned. My question related more to how to deal with grievance and recompense and whether it's possible.
Can you speak a little, because I can't hear you.
Grievance, how to deal with grievance with having harmed another being or person and sort of ahimsa in retrospect, because it's all very good and nice to refrain from harming in the present. And I think it's related to there's a lot about blame in Buddhism and guilt and essentially is blame turned against oneself, but then the other person may be constantly blaming the person who harmed them. So it's a kind of how to.
Yeah, no, this, in a way, I think this is part of the acceptance, that in a way we have to accept that we have harmed other people in the past, and the fact that we cannot change it. I think this is very important to really deeply accept it. Then we can try to see if there and then or later on we can, how do you say it in English? We can repair. We can do something which repair the harm that we've done. And sometimes there is no possibility whatsoever, because, for example, you never meet the person again. Or sometimes the person will, as you say, keep on blaming you. And in a way, you have to accept the blame and at the same time not grasp at the blame, because you are not doing this anymore. You did it and you cannot change it. So in a way, you have to accept both, that you did it, but you're not doing it again. And if they blame you, you just, in a way, have to accept it and maybe not spend so much time with them, possibly. But again, you have to see that. It's complicated. So then, you know, you have different conditions.
Well, we have to stop, actually, but just one last point on that. In a number of Buddhist writings, they're very clear about the fact that we tend to confuse the person with the act. The problem is what is the action the person committed, but so easily and so readily, we tend to assume that a person who's committed a certain act, like we mentioned yesterday with criminals, that they're somehow essentially tainted by that deed. That they are a murderer or a thief or a this, and that identity somehow resides in their very soul, rather than seeing this is a human person like myself. And again, this is what I really learned from working with thieves and murderers and so on, and to somehow differentiate the action from the person. The person, of course, is responsible for that act. The person has to live with the consequences of that act, but it's unjustified to then somehow label the person thereby as evil. The person made an error, and the person must recognize it, accept it. Society will punish them in some way. Their conscience, their own experience will carry that sense of remorse or whatever it is, possibly for the rest of their lives. But that is not them. That is not the person.
That if they did it one time.
Even if they did it 1,000 times, it's still not their essential nature.
They could have strong tendencies. See, yeah, and then that's why, you know, society, you know, that's where rule and regulation, the law was instituted.
But what I saw in the prison is that there's a sort of line that some prisoners cross where they actually identify with being murderers. And they even take a perverse pride in it. They identify with being, in the prison jargon, cons. There's the, in the prison population, they're the cons, and there's the prisoners who are serving time. The cons have basically crossed the line in which they say what we do is justified and society is wrong. And once they've crossed that line, there's not much you can do. They've actually personally identified with being a convict in whatever particular branch of crime they work, and then it is very difficult in a way for a justice system to really do much but just periodic incarceration, because a con has basically made a negative contract saying, I'd rather have periods where I do what I want, I steal, I get rich, I have a great time, and the price I'll pay is every few years I'll spend a few years in the banger, in the lockup, doing bird, as they call it. Bird in a cage. Yeah, well, they are very difficult to have lamb, because in a sense they've stepped outside of the conventions of society. And that is very difficult. Very difficult. We have to stop on that cheerful point. And we'll meet again here at 7 o'clock.